Talk is a welcome for Lynette O. of Visalia.
Thank you, Bethany. I am Lynette, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Bill, for the invitation to speak to you all tonight. It is very much an honor for me to carry the message of hope to another alcoholic who was suffering as I was. My sobriety date is June 5th, 2018. And so that makes about 2 years, 6 months, and I don't know, maybe 26 days or so, something like that. I first want to qualify myself as an alcoholic. Can you hear me okay, Bethany? Okay. I first want to qualify myself as an alcoholic. I took my first drink when I was 18 and got drunk and loved the way it made me feel. It took away everything that I was feeling, good, bad, and ugly, and that worked out really well for me. I loved it. I proceeded to drink every day and get back every day for the next 30 years, so pretty much my entire adult life. And alcohol worked for me until it stopped working for me. My alcoholism was something that I thought was an addiction, cigarettes, it was just an addiction that I could quit at any time that I wanted to. I had no idea that it was something that I absolutely did not have control over. I found that out later. So I love drinking because I love the oblivion. And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous by way of the hospital and not too far away from death. And I'm sure that a lot of folks can relate to that. The last 7 months of my drinking career was spent drinking 24/7 in my bed, in my bedroom with the blackout curtains. And that was it. So at that time, I had a decision to make. I looked around one day on June 4th and I said, how did I come to this? How did I get to this? What happened? What happened to my life? Because prior to, I was a functioning alcoholic. And so I made the decision. I knew that I wasn't going to be alive much longer, so I made the decision to go ahead and go to the hospital. I went to the hospital. The second night in the hospital, I became overwhelmed with the greatest fear I've ever known in my life. I knew at that point that I was just going to get well a little bit in the hospital and that I was going to go home and I was going to keep drinking and I would end up back here again. That's when the realization hit me. See, I didn't do the first step. The first step did me. I realized then I am powerless. For the first time in my life, I am powerless over something. And it scared me to death. And just as Joyce read the part of the chapter 7, working with others, the 12th step is to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. So that night in the hospital, I reached out for help. I didn't know AA, I didn't know what it was about, but I reached out for help, and when I did, two members of Alcoholics Anonymous came to me and carried the message of hope to me. And it was the first time in my life that I thought maybe I could be a sober person. I had no idea what that was all about. I will be always eternally grateful for those two folks who came into my hospital room and carried that message of hope to me. The one thing that impacted me that night was one of them said AA works, and that's when I started becoming hopeful, and I thought, you know, if it works for them, maybe it'll work for me. Maybe I can be a sober person. I had no idea what that would look like 2.5 years from that point. I got out of the hospital. One of them brought me an AA book. I started reading the big book. I started going to meetings. I went to a meeting every single day because that's what was suggested of me. That's what was suggested to me. And so I went to a meeting every single day. I got a sponsor. I worked the steps. And gradually my life began to change. The good Lord removed the obsession to drink from me while I was still in the hospital. Thank God for that. And my life began to change. I am a walking miracle today because I get to live a sober life. I was basically reborn when I joined the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got a new close relationship with my God, one that I've never known before. I found out that not only does God love me, other people love me, and I learned to love myself. And I learned that I am worthy. And that was a huge thing for me, to actually know that I am worth something. And I've often wondered what my purpose in life was. And through the 12 steps, I have come to know that my purpose in life is to carry the message of hope to the alcoholic who still suffers. I'm very passionate about that. I love seeing newcomers. And I am grateful today for this program. Because I get to live a sober life, and I get to live a life that I never dreamed possible. See, AA taught me to be sober, and then AA taught me it taught me that I could live a sober life, and then it taught me how to live a sober life, and it's given me the tools that I need today to walk through this life and face things that are just common life things without picking up a drink. It has allowed me to see when I drink to oblivion, I feel nothing. So I lost a lot. Now this program has given me back the ability to feel. Now of course when I first started thawing out, it didn't feel that great. But you know, if you go into oblivion, you give up the ability to feel good things. And being sober today, I get to feel all the good things. And I feel the bad things too. I feel the pain. I've had heartache during these last 2.5 years. But I will tell you that not one time has anything been so tragic that I've had to think about picking up a drink. And I know from the people that have gone before me that I can live a sober life without having to even consider that. See, it's the hope that was brought to me, and the hope turned into reality. My God restored me to sanity. The promises that are talked about in the big book have come true for me very early on. And I am grateful that I get to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. I will tell you, if you are new, I'll tell you like I was told, keep coming back. Get a sponsor, go to meetings, get into service, do the steps, read the big book, pray, work with others, Those are the things that was suggested to me, and those are the things that I do. And I have found out that by doing those things, I can stay sober today. I get to stay sober today. And the blessings that have come to me from being sober are amazing. I have an AA family that I wouldn't trade for anything in the world. I've got friends that I have bonds with in this family that nobody else can touch. I get to walk through life sober, enjoying and every moment. I have relationships with my family that have been restored that are better than the relationships that I even had before with them. And I'm amazed. I'm in awe of this program and what it has given me. And my hope is that something that I have said this evening that might have touched somebody and given somebody an idea, a flicker of hope that possibly AA could work for them too, because it's worked for me for the last 2.5 years. It's worked for folks that have come before me that have 10 years sober, that have 45 years sober, that have 35 years sober, and we all have today. We all have today to be sober. And I am so grateful for that. I do want to read, I'm going to wrap this up. One of the traditions, the fifth tradition, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. The 12th step of Alcoholics Anonymous says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, see, my mind has gotten clearer, and I can see things more clearly now because of that spiritual awakening. As a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. I'm not perfect at it. I do try every day, and I just want to be... I want to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers, because I want to give back, because I am alive and sober today, because somebody, a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, took that 12 steps seriously, and they brought that message of hope to me. They carried the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to this alcoholic who was suffering greatly, suffering so greatly, and I am alive and sober today, and I have the best life ever because of that. So again, thank you. If you're new, please keep coming back. This program works, and it's not hard. It's easy, and the rewards are great. Again, my name is Lynette, and I'm an alcoholic, and thank you all for letting me share my experience, strength, and hope with you tonight.
Thank you so much, Lynette. Bethany's still an alcoholic. Now it's my privilege to introduce tonight's main speaker. Please help me offer a warm Tulare County welcome to our speaker tonight, New York Dave from, not New York, but Eureka, California. Mr. New York Dave, if you want to mute yourself, there we go.
Can you hear me? How long do I have to speak? Somebody tell me.
Up to an hour.
I'm Dave, and I'm an alcoholic. I don't mean maybe. I was born in New York City, hence the name New York Dave. Back in New York, of course, they probably call me California Dave by now. But anyway, I started out life kind of crazy, you know. My biological father, when I was about 3, left to get a pack of cigarettes and never came back, and I never heard from him or got a card or a phone call or anything the whole rest of his life. And at the tender age of 3 years old, I took that on myself. That was my fault. If I would have been quieter, or if I would have been a better son, or whatever, you know. I took responsibility for that, and shame began to get instilled in me very early on. Now, back then, back in the 1800s, when I was young, divorce was still very much stigmatized, and my mother got divorced, and she didn't like the stigma, so she had to get married again real quick, and she married an alcoholic, because that's the fastest way to get married, you know? He was the nicest guy in the world when he wasn't drinking, but when he was, it was like that whole Jekyll and Hyde personality, you know? And after a while, I began to get beaten. And at about 5 years old, we lived in a three-story house. My grandmother was the middle floor, the demilitarized zone, and my parents moved my older brother and me up to the top floor. I was 5 and he was 7, because they had a couple stepbrothers in rapid succession. So I was raised by a black and white television set up there. And I watched all these shows like Father Knows Best and Ozzie and Harriet and all these things, and I felt cheated, because I thought everybody's family was like that. They were normal. Of course, I later found out in AA that was far from true. But anyway, I felt so shameful about so many things, and I tried to do everything to perfection. I was raised to be a perfectionist with an inferiority complex. I was the smartest kid in my school every year, and I would get like 99.9 average. I went to Our Lady of Perpetual Guilt in Brooklyn, and the nuns wouldn't give me 100 average. They'd give me 99.9. I was the smartest kid in my school, but I'd take my report card home, my mother would say, 99.9, if you would have studied this much harder, you could have got 100. And so I felt like a failure, and I was ashamed of myself. And I didn't know what to do with these feelings, and I was constantly called stupid and Mr. Useless and things like that. I left my socks on the floor one time. My father made me wear a sign up to school, "I am a dirty pig," like past all my classmates and stuff. I mean, all this traumatic stuff. I'd get beaten with belts and put in ice cube-filled bathtubs with ice cubes and ice water, and made to stay in there on a Saturday for like 4 hours, and I could get out like 15 minutes, an hour, and then have to get back in. And at the age of like 11, I was already on the top floor of the house, leaning out the window as far as I could, hoping to fall out by accident, because, you know, I was raised Catholic, and if you committed suicide, you go to hell. But if you just accidentally fall out the third floor window, you know, maybe you got a loophole, I thought. When I found alcohol, I had my first summer love. Her name was Diane. I was 12 years old, and we hugged and we kissed in the summer. And it was beautiful and wonderful. And she did all the things for me that alcohol later did for me. They made me feel witty and handsome and important and like I mattered to somebody. One day I went to call for her, and her parents had moved. And they had not consulted me first, you know. They just moved, and I felt so abandoned. I'd been abandoned by my father, and I didn't realize how abandonment would manifest itself throughout my life. So when Diane's family moved, I was always getting over in my neighborhood as being the funny guy. But I came back around to my block, and I couldn't be funny. I was heartbroken and sad. And my friend said, "What happened?" And I said, "Diane's family moved away." So they bought me a pack of Marlboros and a quart of Schaefer beer. The commercial used to say Schaefer is the one beer to have when you're having more than one, and I was. And the first time I drank, I got drunk and I blacked out, and I don't remember anything about it except for one thing. All the pain, all the shame, everything just went away, like magic, just like magic. And I was eager to repeat that experience once it wore off. And so I began to transgress my own moral boundaries. I would go in my mother's purse and steal money out so I could get something to drink. And that became a habit, you know, rationalizing and justifying my behavior. And I drank from the age of 12 to the age of 36. But at 35 years old, I witnessed a murder in my neighborhood by people that I knew. They knew me. They ran past me earlier in the night chasing the guy they later murdered with baseball bats. And as they ran by, they're like, "Hi, Dave." And they, I found out later that night that they did kill him. And I wound up testifying against them in a murder trial. Now, this was taboo in Brooklyn. You know, you're a rat, you're this, you're that, whatever. Right? I just, there was something inside me knew that that was just wrong to go around murdering people. And then my drinking progressed. I went through the three phases, fun with problems, and then I wound up in problems. And by the time I was 35, I had two successful businesses, and yet I was living on a rooftop of a factory in a cardboard box in the wintertime in New York City. And let me tell you, it's a bit chilly. And what happened was I just stopped going to work because drinking became more important. You know, the businesses continued to do well, but my shame about how I wasn't pulling my weight, I couldn't face them anymore, and I walked away from them, and I wound up living in this cardboard box. It was freezing out every night, and I worked in people's homes during the day, and while I was in these people's homes working and eating their food and doing my laundry, I heard on the radio there's going to be a major blizzard, and I knew I was going to die in that box. I knew I'd just freeze to death. And I told a friend of mine, I finally let my look good, that didn't look that good, I'm sure, told my friend that I was living in this cardboard box, and he let me come down his basement until the blizzard was going to pass. And it lasted for a few days. And I was down in this basement. There was no bathroom in this basement. And I was afraid to go to the restaurant on the corner and use the bathroom, because what if somebody came down with a jug and I missed getting it some, you know? I mean, I was a real alcoholic. And so I held it in. And then one night as I'm looking at the pipes in the basement, wondering which ones will support my weight when I hang myself, because I was really suicidal as all get out by this time, I had no hope. But then, like a miracle, the door got kicked open, and this guy comes in out of the snow with a big butcher knife, and he was one of the brothers of the guys, of two of the guys I testified against. And he had heard I was down in this basement, so he decided to come murder me with this knife, the big Norman Bates butcher knife. And I had a little flimsy coffee table between me and him, and I discovered to my dismay that you cannot defend yourself from a knife-wielding homicidal maniac and control your sphincter muscles simultaneously. You have to choose. And in retrospect, I know I chose wisely. However, at the time, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization filled my trousers. And this guy's stabbing away, and I'm blocking him with this coffee table. Finally, he looked at me in disgust, and he just said, "I'll kill you later, man," and he left. But he wrecked this guy's whole basement. And the guy wound up telling me, "Listen, I'll loan you a pair of pants and clean yourself up in the slop sink," aptly named, "as much as you can. And then you got to leave. You draw a bad crowd." So he loaned me these pants, and I had just made a negotiation earlier in the day, full knowing there's a blizzard raging outside, and I traded somebody my leather coat, my last negotiable possession, for money for a jug. And then I got kicked out into this blizzard in a short sleeve shirt and some borrowed pants and smelling awful, even frozen. And I put my hands in my pocket because they were so cold, and I ran to a phone booth because there was a quarter in the pocket. And I stood there at this phone booth in the blizzard trying to think of somebody to call, and I couldn't think of anybody. I couldn't think of a single person, a single bridge I hadn't burned, bombed, or otherwise taken advantage of. And so I decided, that's it, man. I can't live like this anymore. I'm going to go jump in front of the very next subway train to pull in. And I started to walk 3 blocks to the subway station. I went 2 blocks on the main street in my town in Brooklyn, and I remember this guy saying, "I'll kill you later." So I said, "Oh, I better cut over a block, you know, so I don't get killed on my way to go kill myself." And so I cut over a block, and I was walking down literally the last block of my life, walking down the block of my grammar school that I went to. And as I passed the parish hall, I was ready to pass the parish hall, all the street lights went out from the storm. It was just immediate darkness, but the lights in the buildings were still on. And so this, I had this moment of clarity, you know, like lights out, finality of jumping in front of the train. And I looked up in the falling snow and I was freezing, turning blue like a Smurf. And I said, God, if you have a better idea than what I'm about to do, I'm listening. And I literally took 1, 2, 3 more steps in the snow after saying that prayer. And the parish hall door comes flying open. And this little baldy head pops out. And this guy lures me into this building with the promise of a hot cup of coffee and a donut and maybe warm up for a minute before I die. And he walked me down these steps into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was November 20th, 1989. And let me tell you, I felt like a turd in a punch bowl, if you pardon my French, because, I mean, my hair was greasy as a pork chop, and my T-shirt I was in was all dirty and frozen to me, and I was shaking like crazy. I was so cold, so cold. And some this lady, it was her 10th birthday that night, and she was all the way on the other side of the room. Her friends were giving her roses and cards and hugs, and she looked past them, and she saw me. And she dropped her roses and cards on the table, pushed her friends out of the way, ran across the room to me in high heels and a lovely gown, because her husband was taking her out to dinner and a show after the meeting. And she put her arms around me and she said, honey, welcome. I'm so glad you're here. You don't have to die. I was like, wow, how did she know that? Well, she knew it because we know it. We know what it looks like, that hopelessness, that despair, that friendlessness, that self-loathing that we indulge ourselves in daily and nightly as alcoholics, as active alcoholics. And she made her husband give me his coat, and they got me coffee, and I'm spilling it on his cashmere coat, and I'm so sorry, I apologize. And he's like, don't worry about it, man. We're glad you're here. We're glad you're here. And I started listening, and I knew somebody out there who was crazier than me back in the day, and I saw this guy in there, and he was clean, and his hair was combed, and he was holding hands with people and praying. I was like, wait a minute, how do you get from that to that? And they told me, oh, keep coming back, and you got to get a sponsor. You're having a rough time. Get a sponsor right now. So I asked that guy to be my sponsor, and he told me if I stayed sober for 24 hours, he would sponsor me. So I said, all right. But then the end of the meeting came. All these nice people were holding hands, and they were going to go walking down the street in the snow and go home and have a hot cocoa. And I realized, oh, this is over. Well, at least I'm warm. I can make the half-block dash to the train station and still dive, you know? And we said the serenity prayer, and everybody shook hands, keep coming back, it works if you work it. And then I made for the door, and this guy Angelo and this girl Pat said, hey, where are you going? I said, I don't know. And they said, well, that's our point. So they took me to Pat's father's house. He had 17 years sober then, AA. And this guy washed my clothes for me, and he let me sleep in a bed, and he cooked me bacon and eggs and home fries in the middle of the frickin' night. And he told me, you know, I'm hooked into every rehab in town, man, believe me. He says, I can get you in rehab tomorrow. I said, I don't want to go in rehab. He said, well, what are you going to do, cousin? I said, I met these people last night at the meeting, and this guy told me if I came back, he'd be my sponsor. So Jack loaned me a coat that next morning, and he wound up getting it back too, which is amazing. Gift of sobriety. But he loaned me a coat, and I walked up and down the snowy streets all that next day. It stopped snowing, but it was deep, and I just walked and walked till 7 o'clock, and I walked into that meeting, and I got my sponsor. You know. Oh, and one other thing about that woman who had 10 years that night, she kept holding on to me the whole meeting, holding on, holding on, and I stunk frozen. As I began to defrost, I was like horrible. Oh, my God. And I felt so ashamed. I said, lady, please let go of me. I'm going to ruin your dress. And she told me something that saved my life. She said, honey, I don't give a shit about my dress. I give a shit about you. And people told me so many things. They said, listen to these slogans. They'll be the banisters to the steps. You know, keep coming back. One day at a time. Let us love you till you can love yourself. If you don't believe it, believe that I believe it. You know, and the guy had asked to sponsor me, Jimmy. I saw him the next night at 7 o'clock, and he sponsored me, and he began to take me through the steps. There's 12 of them, you know. A lot of people like to work 1, 2, and 3, or they look at it like it's a freaking menu in a Chinese restaurant and pick the ones that are easiest. No, there's 12 of them. They're easy. They're simple anyway. They're not easy, but the only thing that makes them not easy is our thinking. You know, we alcoholics are cursed with stinking thinking. And you know, I can talk myself out of any good thing and talk myself into anything terrible at the drop of a hat. You know, that's how I used to be. And Jimmy took me through the first three steps. And the fourth step, I didn't know I was supposed to be so scared of it because nobody told me. So I just did the fourth step, and then we followed it with a fifth step. And I thought that he was going to listen to my fifth step and think, oh, God, this guy, what did I get myself into? Actually, he fell asleep for a couple minutes. I thought my things were so bad. But he got me through the fourth step, and he got me through the fifth step. And then I started thinking, wow, you know, maybe this program will work. Maybe I should do the rest of them. And I was doing the rest of them and just killing it. And we got to my eighth step and made a list of like 320 people that I had harmed. And that was just my first eighth step. And I had this list, and then when I went over the list with my sponsor, he drove me to meet with the first 100 people on that list to make sure I would get a good start. And I did all 320 of those people. Was it scary? Yep. Did anybody shoot me or anything? Nope. You know? And the guy who tried to stab me to death, listen to this, when I had like a little less than 3 months sober, I had the coffee commitment. And in those days, he had real coffee cups and ashtrays, and every meeting was a smoking meeting, every one. And I had, my job was to put out the tables and chairs and make 6 big urns of coffee and put out like 70 cups and stuff, and then wash it all, wash the ashtrays out, and hang up the, you know, the shades and everything. And one time I got the coffee coming, and was hanging up the shade, and I was looking right in front of it. It said principles before personalities in front of my eyes. I hear behind me, is this AA? I said, yeah, welcome. I turned around. It was Billy, the guy who had tried to stab me to death. Now, I felt a little bit... I felt welcome. The meeting starts in an hour. And you're welcome to come back. And he was like cussing me out and everything. And so he came back. And he sat right behind me. Now I'm feeling a little touchy. And my sponsor sees something strange in my eyes, and he says, hey, what's going on? So I said, well, you know, the guy who tried to stab me to death that first night I came in, he was sitting right behind me at the meeting. And my sponsor, Jimmy, said, well, what are you going to do? So being the spiritual giant that I was there, like 56 days, I said, I'm going to go get a gun, and I'm going to lay for him in this hallway and blow his brains out because he's interfering with my spiritual program. And I mean, I didn't know that was crazy then, but my sponsor fortunately did. And he said, hey, I'll go with you. You know, we go get the gun. And he says, well, let's go down this way, because I lived on a dead-end street that ended in the East River with a pier there. And I said, but he lives the other way. He said, yeah, just come with me. So we walked down to the pier, and he said, do you like being sober? I said, yeah. He says, do you like me being your sponsor? I said, yeah. He says, you want to stay sober? I said, yeah. He said, throw your guns in the river. So I throw the gun in the river. Now I'm feeling totally vulnerable. I said, what do I do now? He said, pray for him. This was unheard of in my neighborhood. But I was willing to take the suggestion. I began to pray for this guy. And he came for 9 months and sat behind me every single time. But I never worried about him again because I believed that my higher power had my back. And it's as simple as that. You know, this program, if you're a newcomer, welcome, first of all. We're so glad you're here. I am so glad you're here. And you don't have to die. But there's a couple things you do have to do. They're hanging on the shades and the meetings you go to. They're called the steps. They teach you how to live. And the traditions They teach you how to live with each other. So we don't like strangle each other and argue about politics and crap. You know, that's what the traditions are in place for. And I heard you, if you're just getting started in this, start out the way you plan to continue, first of all. Second of all, get yourself a big book and read the first 164 pages. And go to meetings. Meeting makers make it. You know? All these things I was told, and I'd hear the promises read at meetings, and I used to think, I'm too damaged, that'll never happen for me. But it was a lie I was telling myself, because I was so used to beating myself down. It was a lie, because I was amazed before I was halfway through. When I had 2 years sober, I wound up, I had a job, and I hated my job, and I was talking to my sponsor about it. I was back out here in California, in Arcata, Humboldt County, and I was complaining about my job and getting all greasy, and my sponsor said, you don't like your job, why don't you go to school and get a career? I said, I can't go to school for 4 years. I'm 38 years old now. He says, yeah, you can't go to school for 4 years, but today you can go register. So I said, okay, that sounds doable. So I went and registered, and they gave me my classes, and I showed up for them, and my first semester I got straight A's. And I said, wow, that's right, I forgot, I'm really smart when I apply myself to something. And so I kept going to meetings, and I kept going to school, and I'd bring in my paper, and they'd give me a new paper, and we'd exchange papers, and 4 years later I graduated with highest honors in my graduated class as a registered nurse. And I've been a registered nurse for about 25 years, and I've gotten to take the things I've learned in this program, the love that I've learned in this program, the desire to be of service that I've learned in this program, and got to take it out into life, which is what AA is meant to be. It's meant to be a bridge back to life. You know? And I continue to take my personal inventory, and when I'm wrong, I probably admit it. I mean, promptly admit it. And you know, through working the steps, like it says in the 12th step, I love it, it says, as you know, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, like the first 11, you know, you're going to have this spiritual awakening that awakens you to the possibilities, not only in your life, but in the possibilities of the difference you can make in others' lives. You know, I've carried this message. At one time I was sponsoring 40 people, and somebody said, how do you sponsor 40 people? I said, it's easy, only about 3 call. You know, but those 3 are still sober. They're still sober today. You know, and I've had so many miracles happen to me since I got sober. When I first got off the street, when I first got sober, I wound up getting a little room in the YMCA, and I had my own key to something, a place where I could lay my head and pull a warm blanket up over myself and wash my clothes, and I got 2 jobs, you know. And I worked, and one job, I went for the job, and it was working for these 2 guys in the mafia that owned the private sanitation firm. And the guy was like a great big grizzly bear of a man, and I went for a job with him. And I had no self-esteem, so he said, well, you know, he says, well, what do you do? I said, I'll do anything, man. I'll clean your toilets. He says, I can get some refugee to clean my toilets. He says, what I need is a diesel mechanic. Are you a diesel mechanic? I said, no. He said, do you have your own tools? I said, no, I'm not a mechanic. He said, why should I hire you? And for a second, I said, God help me here. I don't know what to say. And I said, you know what? If you hire me, I'm a quick learner. When you teach me something, I'll remember it, and I will show up every single day on time. And he looked at me, he said, wow, you know, he goes, the last guy I had was the best mechanic I ever knew, but he was never here. He said, start tomorrow. So I started, I worked for that guy for 2 years before I came out to California and went to school and became a nurse. And when I was leaving that company, he said, I'm sorry to see you go. He said, you're the most reliable employee I've had in years. And you know, that's one of the gifts of this program. You can be there for yourself, and you can be there for others. And if you give somebody your word, you can keep it. You don't have to remember what lie you told this one, what lie you told that one. You're free. You're free of that. You know, God, God in my meditations tells me all the time. It speaks to my heart, and I'm not schizophrenic, I don't hear it, but he speaks to my heart. He tells me things like, you know, you take care of the little stuff, let me do the heavy lifting. And I've had heavy lifting that needed to be done. In sobriety, my brother got murdered. He got stabbed in the chest and murdered, you know, by a woman that I had only met 1 week before, his girlfriend. And then my father died of cancer. Then my youngest brother died of cancer. I got divorced a couple times and had to sell homes that I built for people with hopes and dreams, and had to sell them and put the money and start over again. And alcohol and sweet old bike starting over again. But I was able to get through all those things without getting drunk. I was able to bury my brothers and my father without getting drunk. You know, and that's a miracle if you're an alcoholic in my stripe. Because when I drink to the exclusion of everything good. I put all my eggs in the one rotten basket. And like Lynn was saying, you know, alcohol worked great until it stopped working. You know, it was like the worst divorce I ever went through. You know, and like I told you, they threw minute rice at my wedding, so. But anyway, you know, in nursing, the last 10 years of my career, I worked in the state hospital in Coalinga, California. And every patient, 1,200 patients, every one of them was either a rapist or a child molester. And when I first got to that place, I hated my job. Oh, God. I hate that I was so judgmental. I put on my Judge Judy robes and just put on my hate face. And the one that was suffering was me. Because resentment's like peeing in your pants. Nobody feels it but you. And I had to begin to pray to God to give me the ability and the willingness to love the unlovable. And, you know, when I began to pray for that, it began to come to me that as far down as I had gone, God didn't turn his back on me. And so I was able to just be their nurse and have them be my patient and have them be fellow humans. You know, nothing happens in God's world by mistake, it says in the big book, you know. And I guess neither does no one happen by mistake. Everybody's here for some reason that I will never know. But I'm content because, you know, I've learned to expect a miracle every day. I wake up, I look around, I talk to my higher power. I think, how can I be of use today to you and my fellows? And my life, like Lynn said, her life has purpose. And that's what my life was lacking before sobriety. I had no purpose other than to keep getting drunk. You know, and getting fights over stupid things. And I'm not that person anymore. This program works you from the inside out. You know? And when you let God in and you let God do the heavy lifting, things get easy. I just want to tell you guys about a few miracles that happened to my life. I was driving around the country just on a driveabout, you know, going anywhere I wanted to, and my car broke down in Texas, of all places. I don't recommend that. And what happened is I got my car towed, and I got a motel right on the eastern side of town. It was the first building on the east side of town in Fort Stockton, Texas, it was. And I was so frustrated, I said, I need a meeting. So I called up into group, and I find out where there's a meeting. And they said, oh, yeah, it's only about a mile out of the west side of town. So I said, I'm going. So I took off walking. And I had no idea that Fort Stockton was as big as it was, and it was going to be quite a big bunch of walking to the west side of town before I can start my mile. And so I'm walking and walking, but I was willing. I said, I gotta get to a meeting, you know. I need my people. And pretty soon, I see a big yellow taxi cab coming down the block. The old checker cabs, the big ones, that you could have fun in the back seat. And I yelled and tried to hail the guy, but he passed me by, and then he made a U-turn a little while later. I didn't see him do it, but he pulls up next to me. There's this old Native American guy, looked like he's about 90 years old. He said, "Get in, brother." So I get in, I tell him where I'm going. He says, "I know just where it is, don't worry." And so he's driving me there. And then when he got me there, because now I didn't have to walk the whole way, I got there way ahead of everybody. So there's no cars in the lot or anything. I started thinking, well, geez, what if the meeting gets called off or whatever? And I'm just thinking to myself, but before I even said it out loud, he goes, "Don't worry, if nobody shows up, I'll come back to get you." So I said, "Oh, all right." So eventually people showed up, and they're like, "A new guy, holy Christ, you're going to share all week, you know?" Because they'd all heard their stories like 11,000 times, you know? And so at the end, I tell my story, and at the end of the meeting, you know, everybody's going to their cars. And so I said, "I got to get back to town." And somebody said, "Well, where's your car?" I said, "Well, I told you, my car's broken down in the shop." He goes, "Well, how'd you get here?" So I told him this big yellow checker taxi pulled up and got me, this old Indian guy, and he didn't even charge me for the ride. The guy says, "I've lived in Fort Stockton all my life. I have never seen a taxi in Fort Stockton. There are no taxis. I was there for a week, and everywhere I went, I asked everybody in that town that I met, 'Have you ever seen a big yellow checker cab here, a taxi cab?' And they're like, 'Nope.'" So I believe that, you know, God does outrageous things. God's got mad skills. And if the word God scares you off, don't worry about that, because my higher power I choose to call Fred McMurray. Fred McMurray was an actor on a TV show called My Three Sons. He was a single dad, and I was trying to figure out who. They said, "A higher power of my understanding, and God's trying to tell me I can be anything. Anything that will be helpful to you." So I'm watching this TV show, and this single dad's reading the paper in his easy chair, and this kid's running in, "Oh, Dad, we're getting all this trouble." And he just folded up his paper and put it down and said, "Okay, boys, how can I help?" And I said, "That's my higher power." But then my Catholic upbringing later in the evening is kicking in. I'm thinking I'm blaspheming, you know. And so the next morning I go to buy this record in a record store. That's how old I am. And I spin this postcard rack around, and right in front of my eyes stops a postcard of the cast of that show, My Three Sons, with Fred McMurray, my higher power. And it was just like God's, I've never seen one before or since. It was like God saying, "You need me to be Fred McMurray, I'll be Fred McMurray. I can be Buddha, I can be Allah, I can be Jesus, I can be nature, I can be whatever you want to perceive me as long as you know it's loving and it's kind. And it wants to help. So ask for it when you need it. Because there's plenty of help. If you're a newcomer in AA, there's plenty of help here. But you gotta ask for it. You know, it doesn't help hanging around thinking people are gonna read your mind and meet your needs, because that doesn't happen. You have to get humble and say, 'I need you now.' You know? And I suggest you get a phone number after every meeting if you're just coming in, you know? Better to have them and not need them than need them and not have them. You know, I had a phone list like a mile long in Brooklyn, and I was using it all the time. And one night I was going through something that was so big and so horrible, I had to call somebody. And so I'm calling all these numbers. I kept getting message machine. And I said, "I'll just keep calling until I get a human." Finally, somebody picked up the phone. "Hello?" I said, "Oh, now I'm ready to dump my shit." I said, "It's Dave." They said, "Oh, thank God you called. I was just going to kill myself." I said, "Whoa, don't do it. I'll be right there." So I ran like 5 blocks to his house, and I got him and took him to this place where they're meeting 24/7 on St. Mark's Place in Manhattan. And we sat through like 5 or 6 meetings. I don't even remember how many. Finally, I feel better now, man, you know. And so we gave him a hug, and we're walking to the train station. He said, "By the way, what'd you call me about anyway?" And to this day, I can't remember. I can't remember. But it certainly seemed monumental at the moment. But that's how God uses us, in ways that we least expect it. And all I have to do is be willing. All I have to do is say, like, make me an instrument of your will. Like right now, you know, somebody said to me before, well, what are you going to talk about tonight? I said, I'll be goddamned if I know, because I don't do the talking. God is like Jeff Dunham, and I'm like, you know, the dummy, the ventriloquist dummy. And I'm confident that through no fault of my own or no wonderful aspect of my personality, that something I'm saying is going to touch somebody, and it's going to reach somebody, and it's going to help somebody. It's going to bring somebody hope, to let them know you're loved, you're important, you're necessary to us. You know, it's wonderful to be part of an us instead of just a solitary me. Because, you know, left to my own devices, I'm self-destructive, self-loathing, and willing to evade all responsibility at all times. But sobriety has given me a second shot at this life. And had I jumped in front of that train on November 20th, 1989, I assure you, I would have missed the most wonderful experiences, the most wonderful people that I've ever known, the most caring, the most helpful, the most sincere. Not everybody, I mean, AA is not a hotbed of mental health, but you know what? The ones that are insincere, keep coming back. Keep coming back. Let God plant a seed in your head and let us water it. And let us love you till you can love yourself. Because that's a full-time job. You know, every morning that I wake up and I'm not dead is another successful day for all of you and for my higher power. If you have children, they don't have to grow up seeing you impaired. They don't have to grow up seeing you being emotionally absent, or financially unstable, or, you know, I used to hear my dad coming into the house, and we could tell by his footsteps in the hallway what kind of night it was going to be. You know, I raised two kids, and I never yelled at them, and I never spanked them, and I never discouraged them from doing anything that they liked doing. And that's because I learned how to live and let live in this program. And you know, there might be some people out there thinking like, oh, this guy's talking too much or whatever, and you might be right, but maybe I should go to on and on and on and on. You know, it's like for people who talk too much. But I don't know how long I've got left. Let me look at my watch here. I will tell you. Another miracle that happened to me in early sobriety when I was living in the YMCA is one night I came home from a meeting after I'd worked my two jobs, gone to a meeting, cleaned all the cups and ashtrays and everything, went home and I was reading my bed book in my underwear, laying on my bunk, thinking how grateful I was to have a room to live in. And I heard a voice inside of me somewhere say, "Walk to the roof, Dave." And I tried to ignore it. Go up to the roof, Dave. Go up to the roof, Dave. Finally, I got dressed, got an orange juice, my cigarettes. I went up on the roof, and I didn't know why I'm on the roof. And I look across the river, and from Brooklyn, you can see the New York skyline. The Empire State Building, the Chrysler Building, the UN. And there was this light lit up over the city. This cloud was lit up over the city. It looked like there was a bulb inside, and it was so bright. I thought, that's interesting how the city lights made it look like that. And then I'm wandering around the roof aimlessly, looking down. Not a leaf is blowing. And people, you know, not a paper is blowing in the street. But up on the roof, it starts getting so windy, literally my hair is standing out back behind my head like that. And I look, and now this lit up cloud was over the East River. And it was moving toward me. And I know this sounds like I'm insane. Believe me, I know. But as it got closer to the Brooklyn side, still completely illuminated, I heard this thing inside me say, "I'm proud of you. I'm with you now. I've always been with you. and I'll always be with you. And he repeated that, I'm proud of you. I'm with you now. I've always been with you, and I'll always be with you. And I felt like Moses or something. The wind is blowing, and then the cloud began to move back in the direction it had come from, over the river, and the further away it got, boom, just went out. And it was just a regular cloud. And I thought, maybe this one of those acid flashbacks they tell you about. But I resolved not to tell my sponsor about it, so of course the next day I did, because you're only as sick as your secrets around here. And he said, yeah, Dave, he says, God knew you were such a knucklehead, he had to make a personal appearance. I said, well, thank you for sticking that pin in my balloon, Jimmy. But, you know, it really has stuck with me, that moment, knowing that my higher power is with me now and has always been with me to see me through the most atrocious things. I drove in a blackout once, completely blacked out from Columbus, Ohio to Tulsa, Oklahoma. And I thought I was still in Ohio then the next morning. That's 1,000 miles. So I believe my higher power has always been with me. And I do believe my higher power will always be with me. You know, and the good thing, if you're a newcomer, let me tell you the best thing about this program is you can make as many mistakes as you want. All you have to do perfectly in this program is the first step. Admit that you're an alcoholic, and that when you drink alcohol, it makes your life unmanageable. That's it. That's the only one you have to do to perfection. The rest of us just stumble and fight our way through the next 11. And you know, it's worth the journey. It's not a destination that we're headed for. There's no diplomas. There's no AA graduation. It's just a daily reprieve, one day at a time, dependent upon my spiritual condition. So if I just try to keep myself cognizant of the fact that there's a power in the universe that cares about me, then I can remind myself to care about myself. And once you begin to care about yourself, you get hooked on it and you start to care about others. You know, a friend of mine had a dog that bit me in the face a couple weeks ago, and you can't tell by how freaking good looking I am, but yeah, it bit me right in the face and in the eye, and I had a friend who's an attorney, and he said, well, you know, I can get like $3,500 for that and everything. And I told the guy, you know, you didn't bite me, your dog did. You know, don't worry about it. You know, in the old days, if I'm drinking $3,500, well, see, that'll take me through Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and maybe Monday morning. You know, but I don't have to be a mercenary anymore. You know, my higher power has provided me with all the financial security I need. I mean, I had to work for it too, but I have a good pension, and my life is taken care of. And it's happened because I took care of myself and took care of others and cared about others. That's why we're here. We're not here to go on Facebook and argue who's the better president or this crap or that crap. We're here to help each other and to love each other and to be there for each other. And if anybody asks for your help, please let the hand of AA always be there to give them a helping hand up. You know, that's our primary purpose, to carry this message of hope and this promise of freedom from active alcoholism, from self-loathing, from self-doubt, from self-negation, and to become a whole person, just like Pinocchio wanted to be. He wanted to be a real boy, you know. I always wanted to be one too. But instead, all I was an emotional chameleon who wore a series of interchangeable masks. I could gauge who I thought you wanted me to be and then try to be that, but that's not living, my friends. That is acting. That's acting a role. And you don't get to write the script. And you don't get to write the ending. So, if any of you got anything out of this, that's great. I know I did. Because God's telling me a lot of stuff out of my own mouth that I need to hear with my own ears. So have faith in yourself. And have faith in this program. And have faith in the love that's here. And the help that's here. If you ask for it. This program isn't for people who need it. It's for people who want it. Who want to clutch onto it like only the drowning will. Otherwise, you're just vacationing from your alcoholism. You know, I'd rather stay on a permanent vacation from my alcoholism because it don't make me nice. This program did. And geez, thank you all for letting me share, and I wish you all had a have a happy new year and you had a great Christmas. Thank you.